Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 22nd of June, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. Well, I've got to say that we just made it into the studio today because, of course, we've had global cooling today. The temperature has dropped dramatically. I waited for advice from the BBC on to what I should wear to survive in these very cold circumstances. But here we are.
It wasn't forthcoming.
It wasn't forthcoming. No. Well, let's get straight on to the reality of UK. And as we pointed out yesterday, the fact that the Queen wore her blue hat with the yellow ring of stars was very significant in this meant that she was not acting as sovereign. So we're now into day two of what is effectively a criminal government, criminal unconstitutional government run by a lady called Theresa May, which I suppose is very fitting.
Very appropriate, yeah.
And let's just have a look at some of the reporting that the BBC did. We noted that in their eminent panel was this gentleman. Of course, this is Brandon Lewis, policing minister. And we just wanted to remind people that this was the very same man who, when informed of all the evidence and testimony of the Metropolitan Police whistleblower on child abuse, did nothing. And we'll just follow that up by the Russia Today report, pointing out quite correctly that the BBC is now ignoring the victims of child abuse. Instead, it's working on an agenda which is clearly there to try and normalise paedophilia. So paedophilia, according to the BBC, should really be called a sexual orientation. Normalise is the BBC attempting to make paedophilia a normal part of society. I think this is immensely dangerous, Mike, and we repeatedly see the BBC pushing this, drifting in this so-called new liberal attitude.
Now, yesterday, the Queen obviously was there in the House of Lords delivering, reading the words out of the little booklet. And no sooner had she finished than she was grabbing her handbag to run off to Royal Ascot, because it was pretty clear that much more important than governance of the country is the horse racing. Well, Prince Harry is quoted from Newsweek, I believe, Newsweek magazine. And he was asked, would he like to be king, or would any of them like to be king or queen? His response was that we're not doing this for ourselves, he said, but for the greater good of the people. But he was asked, are there anybody in the royal family who wants to be king or queen? He said, I don't think so, but we carry out our duties at the right time.
We carry out our duties and take the money.
And take the money. This is the key point, isn't it? How could... Why don't we give the job to somebody that might be capable of it and would want to do it?
I think this would be really excellent. Many people, of course, now say, why do we bother with this monarchy? But if you analyse the monarch as part of the constitutional structure of UK, the right person in the job would provide just such a wonderful lead for the country. Clearly, the present incumbents are not up to the job, as you say, Mike.
Yeah.
Well, what are they interested in? They're interested in horses. And we'd just like to say that we've got this exclusive look into some of the problems that took place at Ascot in relation to security.
What is going on here, Brian?
Well, of course, if you remember a few days ago, Mike, they announced that the SAS would be disguising themselves as beggars. SAS, serving SAS, armed officers would be on Britain streets disguised as beggars in order to protect key people from terrorist attack. And we understand that the SAS were there at Ascot dressed as beggars, but unfortunately this didn't work because no beggars were allowed into Ascot because they're poor people, and poor people obviously not required at Ascot. So this is really quite shocking, because it means that the royal family were exposed to terrorist attack while they were there.
dangerous stuff. Right, moving on to slightly more serious subjects. Theresa May is presenting her Brexit plans to the European Council today. This is the European Council sort of main hall. It's not much money spent on that, Brian, as you can see. She's going to address leaders on her plans. Now, what else is going on at this European Council meeting today? This is a heads of state government, heads of state or government meeting today and tomorrow. They're going to discuss counter-terrorism. They're going to discuss how to better combat radicalization. And they're also going to discuss the Paris Agreement on climate and how they can work together a lot closer on defence and security, Brian. So defence right at the centre. At the end of the day, as I say, Theresa May is informing the leaders about the Brexit negotiations. And then after dinner, they're going to be discussing various things like the state of play in the Brexit negotiations and also meetings in the margins with heads of state expected to endorse the procedure to decide on the relocation of two EU agencies currently located in the UK. So the charade of Brexit continues.
The charade, and your headline is spot on, isn't it? Theresa May present Brexit plans.
Yes,
she may do or she may not.
Now, The Independent was saying a little bit about this. Theresa May told her plans will fail unless she ditches a hard Brexit. This is apparently the Independent saying that MPs are warning her of this. But what was quite interesting in this article, this little snippet here, that the House of Lords, where the Tories also have no majority. And I just find that language quite interesting because, of course, the issue of whether a particular party has a majority or not is not one that the House of Lords needs to worry about. It's not about parliamentary majorities in the Lords, which are there to sort of put a rein on government. This language implies that the House of Lords political agenda, the constitutional agenda, moves on apace as they attempt to lead us into an elected House of Lords where we have whips.
A fully politicised state. And of course, the other thing we should remember is that one stage local authorities were not political bodies. So we had people freely elected as standing councillors. They were not aligned in the local authority to their political party. So we've seen this vicious politicisation of local authorities, which means, of course, that local authorities become centrally controlled by the state according to which party is in power.
OK, let's move on to Grenfell Tower then. And it seems that the chief executive of Kensington Chelsea Council has resigned. He said that Sajid Javid had asked him to resign. Sajid Javid is a local government minister. He had asked him to resign. Sajid Javid, as far as I know, hasn't yet confirmed whether that's true, but that's certainly the allegation. Holgate made a statement. He said, "There's a huge amount still to do for the victims of the fire, requiring the full attention of the council and many others. If I stayed in post, my presence would be a distraction. Serving the family so desperately affected by the heartbreaking tragedy at Grenfell Tower remains the highest priority of the council." I'm not sure I see any evidence of that. But
can I just say, Mike, that this is some sort of oxymoron, asked to resign. Either you've got the moral fabric, you've got the moral courage that you say the responsibility is partly mine, I resign, or else you don't feel you should resign. And just because some IRC minister says you should resign, you stand up and fight your ground that you're not guilty and you shouldn't resign in the first place.
Yeah.
So this is some sort of, what is this?
Well, yes, indeed. But anyway, moving on, it is interesting that the rhetoric in the media has changed once again. So it's now, it was 17, then it was 28 people killed.
58.
And then it was up to 58, and then it was 58, and then probably more than 58, and then it was 79. And now it's at least 79. So the BBC saying here at least 79, and this at least is now appearing right across the media. But the media going a bit mad about the alleged conspiracy theories here. So this is The Independent again saying death toll, cover-ups, media blackouts and D-notices. What is the truth behind the Grenfell Tower conspiracy theories? This is a very good question. Now, just to tell you a little bit about what is said in here, they say Lily Allen told Channel 4 News that the death toll was known to be much higher on the ground, and other people were suggesting that there was that the government had demanded a media blackout, and these are what they're describing as conspiracy theories. They say that plainly there are questions about the tragedy that require urgent answers, not only about how this disaster could have happened, but also about the lackluster response. No wonder these residents have escaped the fire, the residents who escaped the fire are angry. What they've been through is frankly unimaginable. Then they go on to say, in the absence of clear leadership, however, some of the anger has been channeled into conspiracy theories that simply don't stack up. Well, I have to say that the main conspiracy theory that simply doesn't stack up is the official narrative of the death toll. It's simply the numbers just don't add up.
And if you don't agree with the numbers that don't add up, you need government leadership to lead you into believing those figures.
Absolutely, absolutely. So yesterday afternoon, the Prime Minister chaired the fifth meeting of the Grenfell Recovery Task Force. And this provided updates to the Prime Minister on ongoing support for those affected and so on. And the key updates were these. The DWP, the Department for Work and Pensions, has provided £5,000 grants from the £5 million discretionary fund to the vast majority of households directly affected by the fire. And the total amount paid from the fund is now over £488,000. So they've spent almost £500,000 in these £5,000 grants. There were 120 flats in the building. Isn't that about the right number?
120, maybe 126, but it's certainly 120.
Okay, so that number means that they've now paid out to survivors, they say, 88 households, if that's assuming that they've paid out the full £5,500, or 97 households if they've paid out £5,000 based on that figure of 488,000. That doesn't add up based on what we know about the number of dead and injured already, and never mind the number that are missing, right? And then they go on to say that work is ongoing to rehouse all residents who have had to leave their homes, and 68 permanent social housing units have been made available along with more than 160 temporary units. So I'm not certain how many people in the surrounding area have been evacuated and are still evacuated as a result of the fire. But still, 160 temporary units plus 68 permanent units is quite a lot of units if relative to the number of units that there were in the building. And so you've got to ask, why is the need for that many if there are, you know, we still don't know the number.
If there's so few victims.
Well, we still don't know the number of people that escaped in total. That number has never been divulged. Yeah. And so we can't make an assessment of this, but these numbers don't add up no matter which way you look at it. And I've got to ask, where's the, you know, when the Independent is shouting conspiracy theory, when people are questioning this and saying that we've got to be asking the right question, surely this is the first fundamental question. Who has been killed? Who has been injured? Who has survived? And let's get some truth at the very beginning of this, never mind try to obfuscate what's going on.
Well, the confusion in these figures, Mike, is the first indication that something's wrong. That could be mistakes by people. It could be general confusion following the incident. I think that's very unlikely. Or else these figures are being deliberately confused and suppressed in order to cover something up. And a little bit later in today's news, we'll be having a look at how the government wanted to cover up figures to do with defence expenditure, where people within the Ministry of Defence were actually briefed to stall and block the media if they asked questions that were too embarrassing. So there's a precedent for this.
So let's look at another example of where the government figures don't add up, because this is all over the insurance press now. Grenfell Tower insurance bill could be Europe's biggest ever, according to reports, and this is from Insurance Business website. And they're pointing out that the building was insured by Protector Forsikring, which is a Norwegian insurance company, that they had initially thought that the bill would be around £25 million. But now the total payout is estimated to be as high as £1 billion. Now, this was a 24-storey tower block. Brian, what do you think would be the insurance value on that?
Well, I'm going to have to say live. I don't know, but it's going to
But the initial £25 million pound figure seems like a reasonable figure.
At least, yeah.
Right. So if the figure has gone from 25 million to 1 billion, maybe I'm just being a conspiracy theorist, Brian, but it seems to me the likelihood is that they have some indication of the number of dead and injured that require compensation in this case, and they're expecting this compensation bill to go through the roof.
And I think I'm right in saying that this the new insurance company was providing better casualty insurance. Now, I'm sure people out there will know more about that particular aspect than I do, but I believe that that's what I read yesterday. So we had insurance company changed roughly 3 months ago, supposedly to get a cheaper premium. But the advantage of the new company was that it gave a better casualty payout. Very interesting little coincidence. Perhaps some of our viewers and listeners might like to check that. Well, let's have a look at Grenfell Tower from a different aspect. And the Independent here picking up on Kensington Council's £274 million reserves, which it says caused outrage. Then the article says the truth is even worse. Now, I'm going to encourage people to read this article because I believe it is truly appalling, and we're going to dissect a bit of it. What is this article really about? I think it's spin and it's designed to take people off the important issues. Well, this is the journalist, James Moore. He calls himself a journo. So in the article, this is part of his report, the Royal Borough Kensington Chelsea is far from the only borough to boast what appear to be very significant reserves. The most recent accounts of the nearby Labour-controlled Hammersmith and Fulham Council show its usable reserve, for example, were nearly identical at £267 million during the 2015-16 financial year. He also says, if the London Borough of Oh Christ, how do we operate after 40% cuts, Ham, were to spend all of its usable reserves as part of its general running costs, it could find itself in a truly terrible situation were the roof to fall in as the result of an unexpected shock. An example of that might be an economic crunch in the event that the government mucks up the Brexit negotiations. So here's the political spin, Mike. We're protecting the councils on the basis of Brexit negotiations, when of course these reserves have actually built up over a great many years, nothing to do with potential Brexit problems at all.
So that excuse is the standard council excuse. This is the standard patter, or what's the line that's given. So he is not offering any. This is not his opinion or his comment. This is him regurgitating the official line, and this is the line that they were using back in 2007 and 2008 when they were justifying the fact that the usable, much of their usable reserves had been invested in Icelandic banks.
Yes. Now, he does mention some of that. There is a bit of analysis around that, but essentially this article is about protecting the councils and attempting to justify their reserves, of which the major excuse he uses is Brexit. Now, this was breathtaking. The next bit is breathtaking journalism. I just thought it was tremendous. The thing you have to understand about reserves is that any half-decent accountant will tell you once they're gone, they're gone. So here we've got a journalist. Presumably this man is paid a lot of money to write for the Independent. He needs to consult accountants that when your reserves are gone, they're gone.
Yeah, good stuff.
Really brilliant. And on it goes. But when it comes to the council's reserves, we're looking at the wrong issue. What we should instead focus on is how central government's funding famine is starving local government of necessary resources. Now, this is completely fake news, because the real issue is the excessive council reserves, which have been created on the back of unlawful local taxation of local people, which itself has been hidden by fraud.
Yeah.
So is this man another one of the ignorant mainstream journalists? Is it that he's too lazy to get in there and do the real research? Or is this man somehow working to an agenda to protect these very wealthy borough councils that are trying to claim that they don't have any money. Well, if you're interested enough to start to really look into how this system of fraud works in local authorities, no better place to go than to have a look at some of the work of British Constitution Group member and retired police officer John Hurst. Now, John has given lots of talks on the subject of the Constitution and how we need to get back to the protection of our Constitution. But he's been kind enough to send us some material about this aspect of these reserves. And this is what he had to say. What this independent newspaper argument attempts to conceal is the fact that local authorities can raise taxes each year and vary the amount as necessary. This is what setting the annual budget is about. A small operating reserve is reasonable. Any more than that is, I suggest, in breach of the Petition of Rights 1627 and the Bill of Rights 1688, because it is a loan or levy not authorised by Parliament. Our ancestors fought a civil war to secure these protections for us, knowing that corrupt rulers might try the same tricks against us in their future. Now, this is very astute analysis because, of course, what John is not saying is that local councils shouldn't have money and be able to raise some money. What he's talking about is the raising of excessive and oppressive taxation, which is not being used for the benefit of people. It's being stashed away in little private bank accounts. So let's follow on through with the next one here. He says that the Bill of Rights says levying money for or to the use of the Crown by pretence of prerogative without grant of Parliament for longer time or in other manner then the same is or shall be granted is illegal. So he's quoting there from the document itself. And this is the key issue that we're seeing these local fiefdoms now. They are controlled from whichever the political party is in power. But local fiefdoms simply taxing people. And of course, what happens if you don't pay your council tax? Then the local authority is going to hire a court, a place of business, and it's going to attempt to impose an unlawful fine for the fact that you haven't paid a tax which is unlawful in the first place. So I would very much hope today that if we have local residents from Grenfell Tower or that area of Kensington and Chelsea, that they'll be picking up on this. This is one of the places to go to. So if you have a look on the UK Column website, there is this article, the Section 151 officer, council tax and fraudulent accounting. And this is a particularly detailed yet clear article by John Hurst showing people who holds the responsibility, the overall responsibility for accounting within a council. That is the nominated Section 151 officer. And you can read through that article and basically gen up on how this fraudulent system is working. So we've just come back to John Hurst here. This is part of it, which people might like to freeze the screen to read for themselves. Sorry, bear with me. Section 151 officers have an obligation to make reports on unlawful activity by officials acting or about to act against the interests of taxpayers to the councillors. The intent of Parliament was presumably to prevent cover-ups by officials. I can see why being a Section 151 officer could be stressful. People could start questioning austerity. And did you notice that he also has an obligation to report on unlawful actions by members of a police force funded by the council? So John Hurst is really on the button here. If you start to ask the questions of that Section 151 officer, he or she has the overall responsibility to see what the what is going on inside the council, but also what's going on inside the local police force. Truly excellent. Well, we won't end there because let's come back to the illustrious Mr. Moore. He mentions this gentleman, campaigner Joel Benjamin, says certain local authorities looks surprisingly similar to hedge funds if you examine what they've been doing, all with the aim of keeping their services up and running as the cold wind of austerity has blown through Britain. Here's the excuse drifted in again, Mike. It's all to do with austerity. No, it isn't. These councils have been up to this game for a very long time, and this is how they've been able to defraud the council tax-paying public of their hard-earned money in order to build up these reserves.
But he's also promoting this lie of austerity. If we're living in such austerity, why is government borrowing going up year on year? We're borrowing more money. The government is spending more money. What's it spending it on? That's the question, because we're getting less and less for it.
Well, one thing it's spending it on for sure is munitions for the unlawful overseas wars. We took a little look at Mr. Benjamin, and it didn't take long to see where we could find him, no less writing articles for Open Democracy. Now, I might be mistaken here, Mike, but I believe that Open Democracy is supported by Mr. George Soros,
yes,
hedge fund manager. So I'm a little bit confused why James Moore would recommend Joel Benjamin when he's connected with Open Democracy. But of course, it doesn't end there, because if we have a look, that organisations he's also involved in are these rather smooth change organisations, campaigners. But I'm a little bit nervous about the connections back into Mr. Soros. Mm. And we'll end on this note. If you want to know where the scam goes, well, of course, the Mail here is pointing out that there's massive cuts to come in the NHS as a result of the scam of austerity. And this report is about a leaked Guardian article, a leaked report that went to the Guardian. And it explains how managers in North Central London are considering a series of capped expenditure plans. These include extending the maximum waiting time for operations, scans and outpatient appointments beyond the current 18 weeks. They're also contemplating extending the list of procedures deemed to be low priority and heavily restricted. This is really getting towards the total end of the NHS, and all being done on the lie of austerity. It's outrageous, Mike.
Yep.
Well, on a happier note and a financial note, we are going to say thank you very much to all of you who've responded to our requests for subscriptions and donations. We've had a little flurry of donations coming in. Thank you very much. This is always a big boost to know that people are prepared to support us. But I am going to say we do need subscribers. So if you're listening in UK, or perhaps you're one of the many people listening overseas, would you subscribe to UK Column to keep our news reporting going?
Just before we move on, I'll mention that Ian Crane is in the studio tonight, 7:30 for Humanity versus Insanity, and 9 p.m. for Fracking Nightmare. Join us on the live stream, ukcolumn.org/live. Now, Brian, yesterday we mentioned that the F-35 was sitting on the ground in Paris, and I was wondering whether it would actually take to the skies. Well, you'll be pleased to know that it did take to the skies yesterday. And apparently the display was so impressive that it should put to rest any concerns that anybody has about the capabilities of the F-35. It flew around a bit and landed. It was really good. So no mention in Paris, as far as I know, of it trying to kill its pilots by switching the oxygen supply off. And I suppose at an air show, the display will be at such levels that's not a problem. But nonetheless, it did actually manage to get into the air.
Well, I'm very happy for the F-35. Let's bring in the Harrier. And thank you very much to the viewer who pointed this article out to us. This is a Harrier, of course, a British aircraft, effectively. And the Harrier is still operating in America. And it's now getting an update to its data link systems. And this is going to mean that the Harriers can better coordinate their activity with other US and allied aircraft. So the Americans still operating this aircraft, and they're so confident in it, they're now spending more money to upgrade this data link. What that actually means is that the Harrier can share targeting information with other aircraft and ground stations. So this is an important upgrade. There is the Harrier. Why are we interested in it? Well, remember that we still don't have the F-35B operational in UK, either from static airfields or from the Queen Elizabeth class aircraft carriers. But remember the background. So Harrier jump jets sold, quote, for peanuts. This is going back to 2011, when the treasonous Conservative government simply gave away these aircraft and rendered the Royal Navy aircraft list carrierless, effectively. And this is part of the article from the Mail on the same thing. Languishing in Arizona, our once mighty fleet of Harriers sold for the price of just one of their US-made replacements. So the Americans took the design and started to build some themselves. 72 Harriers sold to the US for $114 million. This is financial fraud on the nation. This is assets, yeah, public assets being sold undervalued. This is a criminal offence, and this reflects the nature of this criminal Conservative government that we've got in post. Another article here, which is talking about the fact, and what it's saying is that when these aircraft were sold off, basically MOD officials were told to, quote, stonewall awkward questions from the media. So if you are undertaking a criminal act, as the government was on this occasion, they had to cover their tracks. So they said to the press people, you make sure you don't tell the public what's going on. And of course, who were the key people? Well, let's bring them up on screen. Cameron Liam Fox was the main defence minister at the time, and Philip Hammond took over from him. This is, in my view, criminal activity. It's certainly criminal activity by the government, and ties in well with the present state of Parliament as a criminal government in Westminster.
Yes. Now, the Pew Research Centre has been doing some research in Russia on what Russians think about Vladimir Putin. But before we mention that, Brian, I just wanted to ask you what your thoughts were on this NATO F-16 buzzing, the aircraft that the Russian Defence Minister Sergei Shoigu was. This goes well beyond the normal antics between Russia and NATO of sort of flying alongside spy planes or fighter jets that happen to be transiting through international airspace. This is effectively making a direct threat against the Russian government, or am I over-egging this?
No, I think you're spot on here. In military terms, Mike, all sorts of games go on, and it's very usual for aircraft to buzz each other. Pilots like to play games. They think they're being very clever doing this. Sometimes they make close proximity passes for very detailed photographs. That is certainly one of the reasons that they do these close passes. But if you know that you've got a senior, we'll call it head of state, on board, and you're playing the same games against that aircraft, I would say that is hostile action. And I am certainly not surprised that the Russians countered with their own aircraft in order to warn off the Americans. I think we're beginning to see, is it Trump or should we be saying the American deep state administration is rapidly showing itself to be out of control and extremely dangerous as a military power?
I think it's not Trump, but I think Trump does not have control of these people. And the other thing is, what I was going to ask has completely gone out of my mind. So let's go back to the Pew article. So Pew Research Center, think tank, lots of very important connections to various the typical big other think tanks and internationalist organizations. And they're saying that that 87% of Russians have a lot of confidence in Vladimir Putin's handling of global issues. That has held steady pretty much since 2014. So this has got to be, Brian, a little upsetting for the Western internationalist organizations and policymakers, because, of course, they're attempting to push NGO activity into Russia with the view of effecting some kind of regime change and building a proper opposition to Putin. But it seems there's no support for that in the country, and that must put what's happening with these types of incidents like the flyby into a bit of context.
Indeed, and I think it is clearly true that Putin has got a lot of support from people in Russia. I'm still fascinated that when I watch Putin talk, whether he's talking with other heads of state or particularly when he's talking to the media, he talks in a very relaxed way, like a normal person should. He's not using teleprompters. He's not reading pre-written scripts. He knows his facts. He's confident in what he says. You compare him to the lackluster sound bites that have been coming out of British politicians for the last 10 years. It's no surprise to me that people in Russia would support Putin from this point of view.
Okay. I think it was Monday this week was International Migrants Day and World Refugee Day, right, as it's properly called. This is the United Nations pushing this out, this particular tweet. Not a migrant child, not a refugee child. A child is a child. Well, I don't see any evidence from the United Nations that they're actually following that notion. Here is the, so it was the 20th of June, so that must have been Tuesday, World Refugee Day. What do they say? In a world where violence forces thousands of families to flee for their lives each day, the time is now to show that the global public stands with refugees. To do this, the UN Refugee Agency launched a hashtag with refugees petition to send a message to governments that they must work together to do their fair share for refugees. On World Refugee Day, held every year on June the 20th, we commemorate the strength, courage and perseverance of millions of refugees. This year, World Refugee Day also marks a key moment for the public to show support for families forced to flee. No mention on this website of why families are being forced to flee or any of this kind of stuff. So why am I mentioning this? Well, tomorrow, Theresa May will announce new UK offers to tackle efforts to tackle the deadly migration crisis, as they describe it, in the central Mediterranean. A new three-year programme, they're saying, to tackle the migrant crisis will reduce the number of people risking the perilous central Mediterranean route to Europe and get humanitarian support to these to those in desperate need. And she will be speaking at the European Council, as I mentioned earlier. She's going to confirm details of a package, I believe it's £75 million, which is going to go towards solving the migrant crisis, apparently. Well, what did Priti Patel have to say? She said the UK has been at the forefront of responding to the migrant crisis, and our work to date has helped reduce total migrant numbers to Europe since 2015. But worryingly, more and more people are now using the incredibly dangerous central Mediterranean route. And she claims that the money, the £75 million, as well as saving lives, it will provide vulnerable people with meaningful alternatives to the treacherous crossings into Europe. What alternatives is she talking about? Because why are these people moving in the first place? It is the activities of the Department for International Development and their foreign aid budget, sending money into various countries, stirring up wars that's causing these people to move in the first place.
And we've got individuals like Sir Peter Sutherland, Bilderberger, who was happy to state that we need this massive migration of people to help build, to help break down nation states and build the EU super state. So we don't see him being grilled on TV asking why he's helping to promote this vicious policy, which, of course, is destroying countries, families, children, everything. We don't see these interviews, but I'm going to guess that the three-year extension plan for these migration operations in the Mediterranean will also be to provide further excuse for the EU military unification, because of course the EU has had a joint effort running for several years now, where the British, Germans, Dutch, Italian navies all been working together to try and stem the flow of migrants. So I think this will be another cynical ploy, Mike, to help bring in the EU military unification.
Well, speaking of cynical ploys, we're apparently going to give hope to Afghanistan. Afghanistan needs to be united now more than ever. Afghanistan needs to be looking to the future in hope, not in fear. And this is these are the words of Stephen Hickey, who's counsellor at the UN mission to the United Nations at the Security Council, briefing on Afghanistan yesterday. Well, why is this interesting at this particular time? Well, the World Drug Report is due out today, later on today. Unfortunately, it wasn't released by the time we came on air, so I can't tell you what's in it particularly. But of course, Afghanistan, as we have reported many times now, Afghanistan destroyed as a nation, and their main source of revenue is opium. This is a typical response from an opium farmer in Afghanistan. Opium is money. Why should we waste time growing wheat? This is what Britain has done, Britain and the United States, but mainly Britain, because it's mainly Helmand province where we were based, that this new industry sprang up again once we got rid of the Taliban in the country. So Afghanistan needs to be united. It needs to be united, I believe, he is suggesting, because without the opium money, the world financial system would already be on its knees. So that's what that's about, I think. And we'll see what the World Drug Report has to say later on today.
Okay, that'll be interesting. Well, we will follow up Afghanistan and what would be the link, terrorism possibly, with this incredible BBC report, man tasered by police at London Central Mosque. Now, this is for a couple of days ago. But the force said it was not treating the incident as terrorism related and said the item being waved by the man was a shoehorn.
Okay, so shoehorns are considered to be lethal weapons these days, are they?
Well, we've got police who are now so scared, or they've been briefed that if you wave a shoehorn at them, you're going to be tasered. Remember, of course, many people have died as a result of being tasered, so the taser is not some gentle response in an incident. A taser is a very dangerous weapon for the police to use.
So there should be an absolute threat to life when you use it, really?
Indeed. In fact, retired police officers have told us that the rules for tasers, in their opinion, should be directly equivalent to a firearm. But nevertheless, we've got a massive report by the BBC on a man. There was an altercation, but he is waving a dangerous shoehorn. The police turn up. They can't deal with him because obviously you would be pretty concerned about that shoehorn. So you taser him. And the public are not doing anything. And I'm going to end on the note that I'm always amused when we get emails or tweets through which start off, why doesn't somebody write a letter to the prison for Melanie Shaw? Why doesn't somebody write to the Metropolitan Police? Why doesn't somebody do X, Y, and Z? And our response is, we are now at the time when it is up to the individual to take the action. So if you're one of the people that do send the UK column these rather unhelpful emails, why doesn't somebody, then I'm going to say that I think you're on the wrong path, and it's coming down to what you do as an individual. It's down to what we all do as individuals if we're really going to make a difference. And I'll just say once again, if you haven't seen the reports from the UK column yesterday about the significance of the Queen making her speech in Parliament without wearing the crown, she was not acting as sovereign, so she was there simply as the lady herself. What we now have playing out in UK is an unconstitutional criminal parliament, which is, amongst other things, directing wars overseas. So I would say all of us should be at the point where we say we all have to do something. That's it for today. We will be back at the same time tomorrow, and we hope, of course, to be joined by David Scott with Northern Approaches. Join us then. Thanks very much. Bye-bye. Bye.